Our sermon today comes in three parts with three stories from three people in our congregation. Today they're going to be sharing about a gift they have given or received, a gift that was significant. And as we hear their stories, I invite you to hear them in light of today's gospel passage, Jesus teaching us to give without expecting anything in return. And yet, as we give, we always receive, because gifts bind us together in love.
When I was 17, about to graduate from high school, my dad gave me a grand piano. A deep, rich brown, weighing in at least 500 pounds, almost 100 years old. The six-foot beauty took my breath away when my mom and I returned home from visiting my grandmother. I saw it waiting for me where my small and extremely modest upright piano had been before. But there were layers to this gift. Some strings seemed to be attached to it that made it also feel heavy when I sat down to play. My parents, you see, didn't have money when I was growing up. And although I knew we didn't have much, all my clothes came from thrift stores before that was cool, we almost never went out to eat. A single visit to McDonald's felt like winning the lottery. And the only vacations we took were to visit my grandparents. I only recently found out that we lived on the brink of poverty throughout my childhood. Unbeknownst to me at the time, my parents applied for food stamps when I was a child, but their application was denied because their income was just above the predetermined cutoff for eligibility. But with some money that my grandfather sent them, they enrolled me in piano lessons, and I loved to play. When I was about 11, my sweet piano teacher told me she'd taken me as far as she could and that I should find a new teacher who could help me advance my skills and even compete. So I began lessons with another teacher. This one was not sweet. She was taxing, exacting, perfectionist. And using her formula, I started competing. And I started winning. I won regional and state competitions here in North Carolina, including a couple down the road at Meredith College. Then, I think it was around early high school, my dad told me that if I found a way to pay for college myself, he'd get me a grand piano. By this time, it was clear that my parents didn't have money for college, nor were college loans even to be considered. So I turned to my only other option that I saw available to me at the time, scholarships and work. Piano, grades, test scores, and extracurricular activities became the tools I had to use to continue my education past high school. So I did. I used them, financing my college education through scholarships and two part-time jobs I worked while a college student. Meanwhile, my dad kept an eye on the classified ads of the newspaper. Yes, this was the days before Google, and the internet was just a baby. He found a grand piano for sale nearby and purchased it for $1,000. The exterior was in really bad shape, so he took it to a friend's basement and spent many evenings stripping and refinishing the wood. Excuse me. Of course, I knew none of this at the time, and I was completely surprised and awed when I returned home to find it in our living room. But still, the piano seemed to have some invisible strings attached to it. It seemed to me at the time part of a bargain, part of a transaction. Americans, especially white Americans, are pretty bad about giving gifts to others. For instance, white Americans have become increasingly opposed to welfare since 2008. This is even though the majority of people who benefit from welfare and social safety net programs are white. Researchers have shown that increasing opposition to welfare is because white people resent that their status might be decreasing relative to the status of people of color. White Americans also support harsher, more punitive criminal justice sentencing than people of color do. This is especially true when whites associate crime with Black and Latinx people. White Americans are also most likely to be known by resource and economic hoarding when it comes to education, networking and social capital, wealth, employment, and pretty much any other sphere you can think of. White people keep what they have to themselves and other white folks. This is in stark contrast to Asian, Black, Indigenous, and Latinx communities where sharing, mutuality, and generous giving are more the norm than the exception. In Luke 6, Jesus has harsh, damning words, curses, really, for those who expect giving to be a transaction, for those who withhold gifts, for those who keep what they have, not recognizing it belongs to all. For those who are rich and who have plenty, precisely because they have exploited others and withheld from others what they themselves were given, how terrible it will be for you. Woe to you. You will be in trouble, Jesus says. Instead, we are to give, to lend generously, expecting nothing in return. The Message translation of Jesus' words says, no more payback. Live generously. I think Jesus is calling us to cut the strings attached to gifts we give or receive. Giving is not, or should not be, transactional. It is an expression of love and generosity. No strings attached. No payback. Live generously. My piano has lived in 3 states, at least. I don't know about its life before I became its owner, and been across the country twice. It is my most cherished possession. I cut to the figurative strings to this cherished gift a long time ago. Now, when I think about it or sit down to play, it is no longer a tool I have to use. Instead, it is a gift that reminds me of my parents' love and sacrifice, something they gave when they had precious little to offer or give. My history with the piano also calls me to critique the broader social conditions that link human well-being to performance, connections, and socioeconomic or racial status, and that reduce giving to a transaction or twist what should be given freely into exploitation. No payback, live generously.
Okay, I'm Nina, and I'm not going to be as elegant as Elizabeth. Sorry for that, but this is a gift that keeps giving. This is a gift that was given to me. Actually, when I was preparing for this, I realized this is the 50th anniversary. I received this in June 1971. So I, too, was 17. And that was September of 1970 through June of 1971. Was very significant for me. A lot of you know that I have shared that I grew up in a very impoverished, abusive, both physical and sexual home. And I lived in many placements through Catholic Social Services. And yet, has those placements, some of them, one of them in particular, I really want, she was going to become my guardian, the family, and I really wanted that. But yet, there still was domestic violence. They didn't call it then. The parents fought, dishes were thrown, kids were beaten by a belt. So I expected that. I mean, I thought that was normal living, to run after your kids with the belt buckle and beat them. I just knew myself that once I could get that diploma, I would never birth a child into this horrible world. There were too many children to take care of because I didn't know how. I mean, the only way I learned good parenting was you still beat your kids. So what happened by the time I was around, I want to fast forward, but when I was 14 through my senior year, I was living off and on in the streets because I was trying to stay away from my uncle who was the sex trafficker. The Catholic high school found out and I needed to be with the family in order to graduate. And my goal in life was to get that diploma so I could move as far away as possible from my situation. Well, this family took me in. It was someone that I went to school with. It was her parents. And they had 2 children that were entering high school. I mean, 12th grade, like myself. They were twins. And then they were a traditional, very devout Catholic family, very loving Catholic family. And it went down. So they had 12 kids, which made me 13. And it was the best home I have ever lived in. People go, and it was a small home when I was thinking about it, because I thought, well, wait a minute, it's two stories. No, it was actually one story with three bedrooms, one master bedroom, two small ones. But the basement, they converted that a little bit into one room for the boys. They only had three boys. So there were 10 girls and three boys. And I began to learn. I felt just as I did when I was young, and I would go and hide out in the church and feel peace. Well, that was like a sanctuary in itself, that home. And I began to learn, even though I was in a senior in high school, that you can be a family and you don't scream and yell. You're not drunk and you're not running around beating your kids. Like, and I'm like waiting for this to happen. Instead, we all sat down. That was a rule. I think it, I don't know what time it was. It was maybe 6 or 6:30. Both parents worked. That was something else that was different. In the 50s and 60s, the traditional Italian Catholics, the woman did not work. The woman did not drive. The woman did not. This, you know, Mrs. Murray went to work. She came back around 3:30. We had chores. We all had to sit down for dinner. 15 of us, big table. That was the size of, and we all prayed. We prayed before dinner and we prayed before bed. And, but then after prayer, we all had dinner, and I'm not used to that. I mean, there's a lot of times we miss dinner, but we all had dinner. We would laugh at Mrs. Murray's cooking sometimes, but it was food. And the parents asked each child how their day was. I'm like, what? You care about my day? I mean, so I learned that that happened traditionally. Every day, people would speak nicely about their day. There was another thing I learned. Their middle son had a situation. I don't know what it was, but he got himself in trouble. And so I had heard, you know, that Stephen was going to be lectured. So I'm waiting for the screaming. I'm waiting for the belt. Instead, there was, after, you know, 7:30, so they asked us to go to our own rooms, you know, play a game or do our homework, because the parents were going to have a consultation. A what? They were going to speak to their son and not beat their son. I was like, so I started learning that there was actually a more peaceful. I loved coming home after school. See, back, just a sidestep, back in Catholic high, in private Catholic school, if you were, if you disobeyed or flunked conduct, you had to stay after school and you had more religion. Well, I love that. So I made sure I disobeyed and I got to stay after school, because then that was another hour and a half that I didn't have to go home to like my uncle or my father. I don't know if they ever got that, because then in my senior year, I was as good as crap. I mean, because I wanted to go home. I mean, I went home. So that's just a sidebar there. But, you know, I was just thinking of some of the things that I mean, one thing is too, this was a home that I can't foresee myself living in, I raised two children. So we had three bedrooms, four of us, two bunk, slept in one that was the smaller one. The master one was the six younger girls. And I think, but we all had to go in line for our showers. And if you know anything in the 60s or so, when you had, all the girls had long hair and the boys had short hair. So Mrs. Murray was, you had 3 minutes. And if you did not get out of there in 3 minutes, she was coming in and taking you out. Because if you were at the end of the shower, the water was going to be cold. Anyhow, I at least got a warning. My friend would come in and says, Nina, you got 30 seconds, get the heck out of there. So I got out, but you know, it was joyful. I just can't explain it. I wrote a poem to them at towards the last month, I never had it. I mean, I never saved it, but I gave it to them, and it was about a true family that is blessed, and how they taught me what it really means to be a family at peace. And they were in tears. But the other thing is, they never asked. They knew that there were things in my family that was, you know, that they would not permit in their household. The only thing I had to do was abide by their rules. When I was there, they did not pressure me. They did not ask about my family. I would come back. Sometimes I would have to leave two or three times a month to go home, and then I would thumb it back to their place. And it was fine. I had my first birthday party there at 18. I never had a birthday cake, and I actually got gifts. And I got this little gift from a friend that Vester thought, she didn't know that until I said that. And she always wondered why this thing was on our toilet. It's a guy popping out of the toilet that says, you know, goodbye, cruel rule, is flushing down. I had gotten that. That was one of my first gifts on my 18th birthday. So, and I got a pair of pants, a pair of slacks, and two tops, because I also didn't have any clothes. That's why I loved uniforms. But I couldn't get rid of those clothes until about 15 years ago. Someone said, Nina, you're never going to get into them. And there's a lot of moth things. Well, to move forward to the Murrays, we had graduation. And three of us graduated, obviously, her twins and me. But they took me back home, which I was going to be going back home. But I was going to be going to the shore the next week, and then I was leaving. I was hoping to get a job. And when they came in, so this is a family that I would say they were between working to middle class. They weren't nowhere near were they wealthy. Each kid had to work, you know, and so on. But they were all going to go to college. But they took the time to have me, to take me home. And there's my father. Passed out, you know, you had to walk over him. He was drunk, and I'm just like this. And then as they left, they gave me these two pots and this. And she said, Nina, you are a very gifted person. You have a wonderful, wonderful protective guardian angel. Keep God in your life, and you will go through your journey, and you will be okay. The pots got rusted because I heated it with kerosene, but this, somehow I kept this all the time, and Esther knows, you cannot buy me a new calendar. We use this. I will use nothing fancy. I could not. I thanked them, and this is all she could give me. She says, and she did this out. I could not go back to say, I could not bring myself back. Once I left, I went 50 miles north. And then from there, I continued. I came down south, but I couldn't go back to say thank you. I bumped into one of the kids when I started going back to college about 5 years afterwards and thanked them, but it was just too painful. And I think they knew that. I mean, they knew how I appreciated it. There were no strings attached. And this means the world to me. Thank you.
Y'all will not believe this, but I have that same calendar. It was given to me by my dad's sister. I think when she moved in with her now husband, and I would guess it dates from about the same time, because I also have some of her fire orange pots and pans from the early 70s. What a small world. And what a task to go last today. Lord be with me. Okay. Some of you might have heard or read some of this before, so bear with me. I'm thankful, so thankful for the twists of fate that brought Michelle Snyder into my life, and that brought her family into my life. 2 weeks ago, we met together to mourn the death of her mother, Claire. I might have made Claire Snyder, mostly Mom Snyder to me, raise her eyebrows and give me a bemused smile more than anyone else in this world. I can still picture her face in the afternoon light on the porch, that smile peeking over a raised coffee mug as the TV muttered in the background. Claire welcomed me into her home. She fed me. She would often launder clothes I managed to dirty. She suffered through sleepovers and teenage dramas, and then 20-something dramas and 30-something dramas, always willing to listen, always a bit puzzled by the ways I'd contort myself into awkward positions in my life, but no matter what, always there, welcoming, providing a place to come home to in the warmth of her smile. What a gift to have been loved like that. And in her wake, she leaves Michelle and Lori, her daughters, their partners and children, and the most steadfast, devoted husband ever, Ken. I will truly lose it if I try to write about him, so I won't, except to say I adore him and would happily die if it meant he never would. I'm thankful for listening to my inner knowing, to borrow the words of Glennon Doyle, which led me to visit Mom Snyder in early September under the guise of actually visiting Michelle, her daughter. Was that the spirit, or was that my spirit? The spirit of our collective om? I don't know, but I'm glad I drove up I-95 in the beginning of September, just for the hope of getting to spend 20 minutes with Claire. She'd gotten sick at the end of July and diagnosed in the beginning of August. And things were not going well. Michelle had warned me not to have high expectations. I'm grateful that I got to lay eyes on Claire before her spirit was gone, even as her body was clearly struggling under the burden of cancer. I didn't have any profound messages for her. I just wanted to tell her that I loved her. I just wanted to hug her and kiss her cheek. And I got to. And then she gave me the most unexpected gift. Claire, you see, was a doer and the daughter of a farmer. And actually, she still lived, or she lived at that time, on her family's farmland, now surrounded by subdivisions in New Jersey. But still, that was her family's farm. Claire was utterly competent, which was too bad if you thought you were. And she always did for herself, whether that meant putting up food from her giant garden or making formal gowns for her girls, cooking meals from scratch, or crafting lessons plans for yet another crop of ninth graders new to Romeo and Juliet, which was her favorite play to teach. In high school, I think she often gave Michelle and I tasks to do just to get us out of her hair. She certainly didn't need our help. And I would have done that. I would have gotten us out of my hair too. I didn't come from a family that had family dinners every night. And at the Snyder house, they were sacrosanct. And they came with vegetables. And it's not that I didn't eat vegetables. I did. I ate green beans and corn and sliced cucumbers, which is three vegetables. Claire made it her mission to expand my palate, and she was not above baking zucchini into every chocolate cake I ever ate there. She often coaxed me into trying things she had grown herself and picked that day, pearls before swine. She was so happy when I turned into a cheerful vegetable eater as an adult. All of her hard work paid off, although she was also terribly confused by it. Anyway, knowing that Claire was this incredibly capable person and such a competent doer, especially as a steward of her land, you have to imagine the joy I felt when she asked Michelle and I that day I visited to go in the garden and harvest the raspberries that were heavy on the vines. And to pull out the spent tomato plants that she couldn't get to. That summer garden had been planted long before she had any inkling that she was sick, and those raspberry vines went back two or three generations. And by the time Claire asked for this gift of help, she wasn't steady on her feet. So working in the yard was out of the question. For once, Claire needed help, and she was going to let me give it. I don't know that I've ever truly been able to give her that before. What a treasure. Claire passed away on September 30th, and the next week, I went back up to New Jersey to be with Michelle as she explored the new territory of life after her mom's death. Michelle usually did things before me in life. I'm what you would call a late bloomer. So she had boyfriends before me and she married before me. Still time for me to get in a first marriage before her second. But in the last month or so, Michelle entered territory that I had actually gone to first when I spent time taking care of my father when he was ill almost 18 years ago. Things weren't exactly the same. They had different disease courses, different situations. But it was a bittersweet mitzvah to walk alongside her during her mom's brief illness. The day after Claire's funeral, let's not get confused about who's passed away here, Michelle, her cousin Susan, who I've known all my life, and I sat up late in Michelle's basement talking about Claire, reminiscing. Eventually, Michelle started crying as she was sharing her doubts about her mother's last days when Michelle was caretaking at home and her mom was receiving hospice services. She was worried over the what ifs and the if onlys. Did I give her too much medicine? Did I not give her enough? And I was given another sort of shocking gift, the ability to share what I knew deeply to be true, that she was able to bear witness to her mom's spirit, letting go of her body, giving up the habits of life and eventually life itself, that no gesture Michelle had taken in kindness was misplaced, and nothing that Michelle had done to alleviate her mom's pain or suffering could possibly have been wrong. We wept together and eventually we laughed.
Thank you for those three incredible gifts, the story. The narratives of our life teach us so much. They teach others in a way that we can connect with, and somehow they resonate. I just so appreciate the three of you being willing to give of yourself to us. I learned from Elizabeth that we actually have the power to cut the ties that make a gift be a transaction, in how we learn to live with the gift. I mean, that I never thought of that, that we can choose to not be beholden, to not to change the narrative of what that gift was about. The reminder, Nina, that simple gifts are priceless in the love that they express. It says something that you still had some strange man on your toilet because of what it represented to you. I'm still not sure I kind of understand it all, but hey, you know. And that it is a gift to be able to help people who are. It is a gift to ask for help and to be able to help those people who have been so competent that we always feel incompetent. Thank you so much. The gift of the gospel is a gift that has no strings attached, that where God through Christ is asking for our help to spread the good news. And it is a gift that is priceless because it's all about love. you all embodied that. Thank you so much.